swimming is the sport of swimming long distances, often over 10, sometimes 20 plus hours in the open water under traditionally oriented rules that allow the swimmer to wear only a regular textile costume, one cap and goggles, and to have no physical assistance with buoyancy or propulsion from the accompanying boat or crew throughout the swim, and you go from shore to shore clearing the water at either end conventionally. So I'm assuming that most people haven't seen a marathon swim or have a sort of really clear idea of what it involves. So what I wanted to do today, it's quite short, 4 or 5 minutes, is to show you a really short film, and it's incredibly amateurish, of my English Channel swim in 2010. Just to give you an idea of what it looks like. We've had a little bit of problem with sound, but you'll get the idea. It's just kind of whooshing and blowing and stuff. And then what I'm going to do is use this, really, as a jumping off point for talking about the role of suffering in the sport's self-narrative and the way other people perceive it. But also then its role in what Loic Wacont, in his book about becoming a boxer, calls the intoxication of immersion. So looking at kind of intense pleasures.
You're still alive.
my distinctly more excited crew. It's very hard work for the crew. That's a long day for them. If we watch people doing something like windsurfing or surfing or kite surfing, those kinds of activities, or some of the snowboarding, the Winter Olympic sports, it's not difficult to imagine certain pleasurable aspects to them. Even if you can't do those things, they look fun. It's kind of playful. Marathon swimming, I think, on the other hand, is much less self-evidently pleasurable. I think when you watch it, I think that most people can see the pleasure in finishing a long swim, that kind of telic pleasure, and also maybe the act of swimming in kind of unusual locations and quite exciting locations. This is my best example. I swam around Manhattan last August, and you'd have to be dead inside not to find that sort of faintly exciting, even if you're not comfortable with the pollution and the location and all of that. But I think in general, the act of swimming itself lacks spectacle. And indeed, most of the action, if you can call it that, occurs literally out of general view. And even that which is visible is unremarkable and repetitive. So from looking from outside, the imagined isolation, monotony, and the discomforts of many hours in the water combines with very common perceptions of open water itself as hostile, dangerous, dirty, cold, and perhaps harbouring unseen predators. And this is then compounded by sort of enduring images of channel swimmers being slathered with grease and fat. And this is a discredited practice among swimmers. Nobody really does this anymore. It doesn't work. But it lingers in the popular imagination. It's kind of evocative of disgust and dirt around the practice. And even arguably the most spectacular moment of a marathon swim, a successful finish, isn't really a photogenic triumph. As you saw from there, rather indelicately filmed directly from behind. But the swimmer basically crawls or staggers out of the water, kind of swollen and quite unsteady. But in spite of this, or perhaps because of these negative perceptions, marathon swimming is a status-bearing activity. And particularly in the current social and political moment where autonomy, bodily discipline, and self-efficacy are prized, the successful swimmer stands easily as the good body, healthy, strong, and maximising their own capacities. And we saw this in the Olympics and the Winter Olympics as well, of holding these people up as role models and the kind of never give up message that we get from these people. And this is a very commonly lauded, the willingness to suffer is a commonly lauded mark of toughness, particularly within the endurance sporting domain. And this gets conceptualized conventionally as the successful exercise of mind over matter. And you see this in the sporting world. There's these endlessly circulating sort of inspirational memes, which position the body as weak and less subject to a strong mind. And if we look, for example, at Leeds, this is in the entrance hall to the Edge. So picking up on exactly the same message, energy and persistence conquer all. And these mind over matter statements refuse the self-evident fact that social, physiological and other constraints mean that it's simply impossible to conquer all things, no matter how much you want it. Mind over matter is a very problematic configuration, and this is very well trodden sociological ground. But the reason I'm raising it is because it's also one that has significant social potency, as well as a common sense element for making sense of the world and our experience of it. And Drew Lader, in his phenomenological account of the absent body, highlights this, and he says that the opposition of rational mind and body may be a misreading, but one which is motivated by the lived body itself, in that the body is rendered kind of absently present when it's well, and then becomes foreign to itself when there's pain or suffering, and as something to be acted upon. The mind-body split, he says, has a kernel of truth to it, and as a result serves as an intelligible resource for accounting for experiences, and I think particularly experiences of duress, and in fact, sort of in spite of every intellectual impulse to dislike the mind-body split, in that moment where Paul comes out and gives me a talking to, it's a moment of extreme physical discomfort and exhaustion, and mind over matter is really the only resource that you have in those moments to deal with what's happening and to make sense of that and act in it. So this framing of suffering and overcoming as laudable in its own right is very evident in the marathon swimming world, particularly in the context of charitable fundraising, where the willingness and ability to endure and master suffering is publicly traded for money. for sponsorship. And this is a framing that dominates the outward-facing representation of the sport, and the creation of what Nettleton and Hardy call the charitable body cements both the link between endurance sport and suffering and the goodness of the marathon swimming body as tough, disciplined, healthful and generous to other deserving others. Pleasure in the act of swimming is necessarily absent from these representations, since the donation of money cannot be traded for something that the swimmer enjoys doing or would be doing anyway. They have to be seen to suffer and to overcome suffering, and this isn't to deride charitable swimming, but simply to point out that it is entirely reliant on suffering to the necessary exclusion of pleasure. Another dimension to marathon swimming's investment in the symbolic value of suffering is the ongoing debate around what counts as a legitimate marathon swim. In January 2014, a small collective of experienced swimmers, under the auspices of the Marathon Swimmers Federation, which is a new organisation, launched a global set of rules for marathon swimming. And this was a concerted and meticulous attempt to delineate the boundaries of real marathon swimming, particularly in the face of the growing popularity of crossings using wetsuits, and also a small number of very controversial high-profile swims that made use of non-traditional assistance while still claiming a record marathon swim. So this non-traditional assistance would include things like stinger suits, which protect, full-body suits, which protect against jellyfish stings, a trailing underwater directional streamer that you can stream from the boat that keeps you on the most efficient line forwards by looking downwards, or deliberately and physically supportive contact with boats or crew, which wouldn't be allowed on a channel swim, for example. Now, these rules, one of the core functions of them is the repudiation of adaptations that make swimming easier or that minimise suffering. So suffering, then, and the willingness to suffer are marks of authenticity, alongside the foundational premise in swimming that it's better to fail than to make the swim easier and complete it. And you see this also in these recurring discussions that happen on the online around which of the extreme endurance sports is the toughest. And so, for example, the English Channel and Ironman and climbing Everest are often kind of lined up next to each other for comparison. And in claiming the primacy of marathon swimming in the toughness stakes, Ironman and mountaineering are relegated as a result of their reliance on technological props, so wetsuits in the case of triathlon, and ropes, bolts, ladders, and so on in the case of mountaineering. And these are seen as a sanitising buffer between the individual and the challenges that are supposedly being met in the natural environment. So the unmediated confrontation with suffering, then, is a marker of both distinction and belonging. There is no question, though, that marathon swimming does involve a wide range of unpleasant possibilities. In the course of my relatively short swimming career, I've been variously scared, hungry, nauseous, incoherent with cold, in pain, hungry, stung by jellyfish, bitten by water lice, and exhausted beyond anything I had ever imagined possible. And yet, like many of my swimming colleagues, I can't stay away. I am captivated by the intoxication of immersion. Similarly, swimmers I've swum with or interviewed fall back constantly on metaphors of intoxication and addiction to describe their attachment to the sport, getting their daily fix, being high as a kite, drunk with pleasure, flying, craving. The outward-facing representations that I mentioned previously, while each signalling a passionate engagement with the sport, don't seem to me to be able to account for these declarations of intoxication, that something else is happening. So, how do swimmers find pleasure in a practice that appears removed from the possibilities of pleasure? My argument here is that simplistic assumptions about relations of masochism, for example, where pain and suffering are sought as pleasures, as sources of pleasure in their own right, are inadequate, even though this explanation of being gluttons for punishment, essentially, is often self-deprecatingly used by swimmers themselves to account for their engagement to others. Nor do I want to make the case that marathon swimming is innately, inevitably, or predictably pleasurable, or that suffering is directly traded for pleasure. Instead, I want to take a more phenomenological approach, and I want to argue that immersion in marathon swimming is an acquired taste that comes to make senses pleasurable through a social process of embodied becoming, in which suffering and pleasure are mutually imbricated in complex and shifting ways. And in particular, drawing on Sarah Nettleton's work on fell runners, I want to argue that the intoxication of immersion constitutes a form of existential, what she calls existential capital, a shifting constellation of visceral pleasures that facilitate social belonging through the inward-facing shared sense of a distinct mode of being in the world that is outside of the understanding of others. So I'm going to very briefly talk about the methodology, although I just sort of did this in my job talk, so you probably don't need to hear that. And then I'm going to look at two things. One is the way that suffering gets recoded and recalibrated through the process of training. And secondly, to look at some of the autotelic pleasures, the pleasures for their own sake, that exemplify this existential capital. So methodologically, comes out of an ESRC-funded project called Becoming a Channel Swimmer. And it's what I called an auto-ethnography. So using what Wacom calls observant participation and alongside conventional ethnographic observation interview methods like Wacom, I deployed my own body, what he calls, as a tool of inquiry and a vector of knowledge. And this involved documenting in considerable detail my own bodily, emotional and social experiences of training in the kind of detail that you wouldn't be able to expect from a research participant, for example, and on a scale that you couldn't ask someone else to do. And I also put the parentheses that are in there because I wanted to keep the autoethnography potentially separate in case I became injured or ill and wasn't able to do the swimming side of it, so it could still be an ethnography of the community and its practice. So the formal fieldwork phase ran from 2009 to 11, but I've also continued in a more selected mode through to the present, and particularly most recently in relation to an injury, quite a serious shoulder injury, that I picked up last summer that kept me out of the water for 5 months. And so I've been writing about what it's like not to swim, but also about the rehab process that I've been undergoing. During the research, I travelled extensively, intertwining the autoethnographic and observational notes, including visits to local training venues in the West Midlands, where I was living at the time, Dover, Jersey, Malta, Cork in Ireland, and San Diego and San Francisco. The project itself is about the process of training and becoming rather than the big swims themselves. Again, because I didn't want the project to rest on me being able to go as far as doing one of the big swims. But as it turned out, in the course of the fieldwork, I did 5 marathon swims. So I swam round Jersey, from Jersey to France, the English Channel, the Catalina Channel in Southern California, and most recently round Manhattan. Living and working in the camper van for large parts of each summer, I interviewed swimmers, documented everyday routines, practices, interactions between and among swimmers, coaches, crews, supporting family members, and curious passers-by in a range of aquatic spaces. I'm now writing this up as a book, provisionally entitled Immersion, and I'm trying to look at the embodied social relations, both of being a body in water and also being absorbed, immersed in an activity. And I can talk more about that later. So I'm going to move on now to talking about some of the ways that pain and suffering get recoded and recalibrated through training, and I'm going to use cold as a case study. So I'm going to open this section by reading an extract from my field notes, and these date back to April 2009, so quite early in my kind of journey, when I joined a specialist commercial training camp for long-distance swimmers on the island of Gozo in Malta. This was my first experience of sea swimming in marathon swimming mode. And this is one of the first training swims of the trip, when I know very little about how to do it, as you'll see. So the boat took us out of the harbour to a spot a couple of hundred metres offshore. We stripped down to our costumes and began the rituals of swim preparation, sun cream first, with its social dance of mutual backslathering, and then standing, arms up and apart, while a latex-gloved guide smeared Vaseline under our armpits, costume straps and the backs of our necks to prevent chafing. Already, I had forgotten one of the first lessons. Cap and goggles on before you grease up, so you don't get smudges on your lenses. Absent-mindedly, I straightened my costume straps, getting Vaseline on my fingers before reaching for my goggles. Beginner's error. I rummaged in my bag for a spare pair, embarrassed at my obviously novice display in what felt like a test. Safety boats were untethered and we were given our orders. A 2.5-hour swim up the coast towards a promontory in the distance and then into a bay, setting off in pace groups marked by hat colour. And then jump. Not wanting to appear tentative, I hurled myself off the dive platform, away from the boat, breaking the surface before resurfing with a horrified gasp. Cold. So much colder than the sheltered, shallower waters of the bay we'd swum in the day before. I gave a couple of hyperventilating gasps, straining to catch my breath, but desperately trying to avoid a publicly humiliating display of panic. My skin burned and prickled, and my forehead throbbed with an ice cream headache. Unwilling to be left behind, I started to swim after the other yellow hats, turning my arms furiously to catch up and to shake off the shock of cold. A second problem. The sea was chaotic and choppy, and I was unbalanced and disoriented by the motion. Months of pool training and careful stroke work seemed useless in the face of this impossibly mobile environment. I mistimed a breath and gulped down a mouthful of seawater, which made my stomach heave. I gagged, retched, threw up, and then the tension of coughing creased my face, letting water seep under the seal of my goggles into the corner of my right eye. Cold, nauseous, sore-eyed misery. I was falling behind my group, and each time I fell into the trough between the waves, I lost sight of the safety boat and the yellowheads in front of me. My fingers were fat and stiff with cold, and I seemed unable to manage more than a handful of consecutive strokes before being upended or having to stop to look where I was. Everything I had read told me that I should learn to listen to my body and to know my own limits as a marathon swimmer. But I was at a loss as to how to interpret this barrage of unfamiliar bodily signals or where my limits might possibly lie amidst all this novel unpleasantness. All I could think about was how utterly miserable I was and how stupid I had been to think that I could swim the channel. Self-pityingly, I distracted myself from my suffering and incompetence by drafting a melodramatic letter in my head to my English Channel boat pilot withdrawing from my 2010 swim. So, writing about the process of becoming a marijuana user, Becker argues that in order to find pleasure in a practice that is not self-evidently pleasurable at the first encounter, you have to learn first the necessary techniques, then learn to recognise the effects, and then learn to enjoy the effects. And we can see this here in the story, where I had only the flimsiest grasp of many of the techniques that are fundamental to marathon swimming. So, for example, preparatory regimens and practical sea swimming techniques, how to swim in moving water. And you might also include things like post-swim rewarming strategies, how to feed during a swim, all of these fairly basic things. And so we can see the acquisition of these techniques as strategies for the minimization of forms of suffering that would otherwise prevent progress in the sport. Saltwater chafing, the intake of saltwater, disorientation. But we can also see the absence of a conceptual understanding of the sensations of swimming. And this is exemplified by the case of cold, in the unfamiliar grip of which my body had literally, disconcertingly become unintelligible to me. These are the sensations that, in Becker's terms, the swimmer has to learn to feel before you can come to find them pleasurable. In everyday non-swimming life, even a modest sensation of cold is usually a prompt to action. You close the window, put on a sweater, turn up the heating. More overt physiological responses to a fall in body temperature, such as goosebumps or shivering, are generally experienced as intolerable and problematic and as a pressing call for rewarming action. But in the case of marathon swimming, and open water swimming more generally, the effect of cold is calibrated on a different scale. And while for most non-swimmers or pool swimmers, water temperature is measured in wide temperature bands, so freezing, cold, warm, hot, regular open water immersion produces a much more refined delineation both of temperature and its effects. So even a single degree can make a difference to the experience of being in the water. I'm much more comfortable at 14 degrees than I am at 12, for example. I mean, noticeably. Okay, and these are judgments that are inaccessible to the novice who's unfamiliar with the process. So, for example, in 2011, when I worked for a short time as a guide on the same training camp that I'd been on in 2009, the swimmers did a six-hour training swim. A six-hour swim is like the benchmark for channel swimming because you have to do a six-hour swim in water of less than 16 degrees in order to qualify to try a channel swim. So it's got this kind of quite iconic status, the six-hour swim. And one of the participants broke from the swim circuit in the bay and paddled over to the beach, determined to get out early. She sobbed miserably that she was too cold to continue, and she held up her arm, which was covered in goosebumps, and she pointed to the goosebumps as evidence of suffering, of unbearable suffering. Another of the guides, a very experienced swimmer who was in the water as well, headed her off, holding up his own goosebumped arm alongside hers, saying, "We've all got those. Carry on." Thwarted, she went back into the water, out into the bay, and finished her 6-hour swim. But what this shows us is what we usually understand as problematically cold doesn't apply in this context. And swimmers have to learn to recalibrate if they're going to go on to find it pleasurable. They need a different conceptual vocabulary for the body. In the weeks that followed my own first Gozo training camp in 2009, the rather disastrous swim that I described, I swam several times a week in much colder water in local lakes, watchfully testing out the effects of cold on my body and trying to identify these new, unintelligible boundaries of safe cold. Using the learned vocabularies from people I swam with and on the course, I described the effects in my field notes, the sausage fingers, the claw, which is your hand basically locks in that position, ice cream headaches, sensations of burning, stinging, biting. I learned to recognise the dramatic post-swim shivering and tense Jordan fumbling bundled under layers. I would pour hot chocolate from a flask into a cup, slopping it over the edge like a drunk. But however disconcerting and frightening it is in the first instance, both to the novice and anyone uninitiated around them who's watching the shivering happen, all of this is normal. This is how it's supposed to feel, especially early on in the season where you kind of have to train, but it's a bit cold, it's still inching out of the cold. But it's not only a conceptual transformation, a new way to read the body. The body itself transforms in the process. So writing about marathon running, Reicher says that training makes the body change from the microcellular to the gross anatomical level. Everything changes. And in latest terms, then, the world discovered through the body leads the body to redesign. So in the case of cold, for example, while the swimmer is learning to perceive and delineate effects of cold on the body and how to react to them, which is habituation as a process, the process of regular immersion simultaneously produces physiological adaptations to cold, or acclimatization, producing marginal but appreciable increases in tolerance. And if at the same time you were to purposefully gain body fat, that tolerance would also increase as a result of that. So my point here is that training transforms both what counts as suffering and how it's experienced. And you could make a similar case for pain. It's been documented in other sports and performance domains like ultramarathon running, fell running, and dance, ballet as well. Swimmers learn to draw refined distinctions between different qualities and intensities of pain. For example, between the lactic acid burn of muscles during a hard training set, or the rather dull ache of hours of repetitive movement, or the bite of a threatening injury. And in this way, we can describe swimmers not so much as gluttons for punishment, as they're conventionally seen, but connoisseurs of suffering, drawing fine delineations through practice across different qualities of suffering and their boundaries. This connoisseurship creates a space for the collective and humorous uptake of sensations that may be experienced as unpleasant or disgusting, but which through learned experience are understood as a threat neither to well-being nor ongoing swimming and training. So in this case, the disappearance, to use Lader's term with a Y, of the body that he talks about, this disappearance in response to pain is stripped of the affective call that pain is usually seen as producing. So one example of this is shivering. Shivering is the result of what's called the afterdrop. So when you swim in cold water, warm blood is held in the core to protect the viscera and the brain, and cold blood is held, so your circulation slows down and it's held at the peripheries. When you get out of the water, the blood recirculates and the cold blood will circulate back to the core, back to the heart, causing a temporary drop in body temperature. And the shivering is a result of that. It happens about 5 minutes after you get out. The shivering is thermogenic. It's designed to produce heat that will restore the body. And in fact, not shivering is a sign of very dangerous levels of hypothermia if you've been cold. And so, but its effects, once they've been collectively acknowledged as harmless, are incredibly entertaining. So these are often videoed and posted online. And there's a Facebook group called the Shiver Club. Specifically, for, I can show you a photo of me shivering later if you want. But these are also incredibly social moments. These are moments when people help each other dress, They talk to each other, they provide comfort, they might provide advice to novices. So it's a kind of very odd clusters of people shivering away, talking to each other and laughing and filming each other. Another example of this is the taking and posting of pictures of some of the collateral effects of marathon swimming that are unintelligible to those outside, such as very sharply marked suntan stripes on the face or thick furry tongues. This is Elaine. Elaine is a very accomplished swimmer. She's a journalist as well, and she's an incredibly good sport because I asked her for photos and she sent them for us to use. After a long sea swim, the mouth becomes ulcerated and thick. And after a couple of days, the dead cells slough off, restoring both the sense of taste and a normal appearance. But after a long swim, swimmers often stick their tongues out at each other at the end of a swim to display this furriness, usually to kind of pantomime collective groans of disgust and laughter. And similarly, we've got the head stripes. That's Elaine again, and that's me in the corner there, looking less pleased with it. Where if you're wearing a swimming cap, obviously, you look like a pint of Guinness. You just, you know, you get this stripe. And again, for people outside, don't know what this is when they see it. And I think particularly for women, it has, in terms of an uneven tan and a facial mark, it can be quite tricky to negotiate. But it's also a source of kind of great hilarity within the group as shared understanding. And I think this points us towards what Nettleton describes as existential capital, a mode of capital that comprises what... visceral pleasures, corporeal resources, and a novel form of sociality. And this isn't tradable for financial rewards or symbolic status, but rather it serves to cement the sociality of the runners, in her case, or swimmers. It's seen as difficult to describe and impossible for those outside to appreciate. It's deeply personal and constitutes a profit that can only be meaningfully shared with other swimmers. One swimmer I met described these pleasures as a precious secret that she carries with her in her everyday non-swimming life. The field notes reflect the constant tension between the desire to articulate and represent these visceral pleasures and their inexpressibility. And the next extract I'm going to read to you, the last bit, is one such attempt to try and say what this is. And this is a six-hour swim at the end of a training camp in Cork. And the swim took the form of one-mile laps around Sandy Cove Island in Kinsale, a beautiful place to swim. The first 2 hours was nothing but slog. A week of hard swimming had left me tired and vulnerable to cold. I felt disjointed and awkward in the water, like a wind-up bath toy, and had already resigned myself to a trudging swim, counting down the laps to the finish. But into hour three, at last, my body seemed to find the water, whole-bodied now. I relaxed downwards like someone finally settling into a chair that they hadn't trusted to bear their weight. I let myself be held, suspended between the opposing forces of gravity and buoyancy, between air and sea. Every movement felt smooth and powerful, as if I was sliding on a downhill, gentle slope. Imagine a big tub of ice cream, left out in the sun momentarily to soften, and then running a scoop gently down the surface to expose a long, smooth furrow. Swimming felt like travelling frictionless down that ice cream furrow. On the outside of the island, facing out into the Atlantic, large swells rolled in, churning up the water when they hit the island shallows. So I moved further out, lengthening the circuit, but where the water had a steadier rhythm into which I could fold myself. It was a clear, sunny day, and the light travelled down through the water in shafts, tiny shoals of fish. I saw the occasional jellyfish suspended a couple of metres below, ghostly beautiful, happily out of reach. The time between feeds collapsed, and I felt for a few brief hours like the best swimmer in the world, like I could swim forever, like the water was all mine. Now, I can talk about this, I've written somewhere else about the gender dimensions to some of this, about the entitlement to space and that kind of whole-bodiedness, which I can talk about later, but I think it also demonstrates this idea of existential capital, of a shared but elusive visceral pleasure. One swimmer called it a comforting euphoria. Another said, it feels like feeds are coming every 5 minutes and time just speeds up. People assume that time just drags, but the opposite is true. And then he paused, struggling to find the words he needed, before appealing to shared experience. Well, you must get this too. Unlike finishing or overcoming, these pleasures have no currency outside of marathon swimming, but are potent markers of distinction within. with only the insiders able to appreciate them. And Nettleton says that this transcends social difference and struggles internal to the field, and that in fact the kind of semi-nakedness of running, in her case, does a lot of that work of stripping down markers of class, for example, and Wacont makes the same point. But I think, and you can see this in swimming, but like the learned appeals of mind over matter, I think this is a kind of risky fiction, and that actually below this we can see gender, race, class, age, ability and disability kind of running through all of this as well. And in fact, swimming is a very greedy sport. It's very demanding of time, of money, of emotional and physical energy that kind of belies that democratizing veneer of everybody sharing something the same. And regardless of existential capital, marathon swimming still presents opportunities for other forms of tradable capital, social, physical, economic and symbolic capital that opens up differences between swimmers and between swimmers and non-swimmers. And I say that as someone who has capitalised significantly on swimming in a very particular way. And that's a paper for another day, but I think it's an important caveat. So the key point that I want to make is that these pleasures aren't directly sourced from suffering, hiding behind suffering or in exchange for suffering, but rather they're the outcome of a unique assemblage of embodied skills, learned sensory perceptions, the mobile, living, breathing aquatic environment, and a very specific style of engagement with that environment, of which suffering is one element. And so Nettleton says about running, the magic, memory, skills, frailties, dangers, pain and fun associated with the practice of fell running permeate the body to yield this personal profit. So there's nothing inevitable about it, and on any given day, sometimes the only pleasure might be thinking about the beans on toast you're going to eat when you finish, or the really good night's sleep you're going to have, and sometimes that's enough. But all these contribute to the assemblage that makes up what Wacont calls the taste and ache of action. So just to finish, I've kind of said that the pleasures can be hard to imagine, and that suffering is a really important part of the outward-facing element of the sport and other people's perceptions of it. And these align very easily with these values of autonomy, self-efficacy, and health and good bodies that we think about, and the expectations that are placed on everybody to have a good body in a particular way. The marathon swimming community uses these discourses, for example, trading suffering for charitable sponsorship, distinguishing between tough sports, and delineating the boundaries of pure sporting engagement. But the process of training transforms also not only these perceptions, but what it means to suffer, what counts as suffering, and what suffering feels like as the body is transformed and is inhabited by the activity. So my upper body muscularity, my cardiovascular and metabolic fitness, the permanent costume mark on my back, my very fragile left shoulder, the thinned hair at the nape of my neck where the swimming cap rips on and pulls it out, the luxurious quality of sleep that I can only get from a long outdoor training swim. I have literally inhabited swimming. So without the cold or the fatigue or the third up tongue, the activity itself ceases to be that which I have come to inhabit. So what can be understood as suffering then isn't a necessary evil to be traded, but an inextricable part of the intoxication of immersion. Immersion in marathon swimming is never only this intoxication, but to focus on the embodied relationship between pleasure and suffering offers a potentially useful insight into a key dimension of the nature and appeal of immersion, I think, across a number of domains, and challenges the very narrow conceptual vocabulary available to us to talk about sporting embodiment and to talk about what we think of as a good body. That's it. Thank you. The red button now.